Do what thou wilt should be the whole of the law. Welcome to the Thelema Coast to Coast. My name is John Crow, and this is the second podcast of Thelema Coast to Coast. For those of you who have not heard the first podcast, I encourage you to go back and listen to it, as the programs on this podcast, while standing on their own, do continue from the previous podcast. In the first podcast, I stated that I would like to keep each program between 30 to 45 minutes. I'm realizing this is not the most realistic. There are just too many things to talk about and present. So my readjusted hope is to keep them between 45 and 60 minutes. On today's podcast, we'll be continuing the interview with Bishop T. Allen Greenfield. In this last half, we'll carry on discussing Thelema and also start examining Liber All. Later in the podcast, we'll have a book update from Magus Books and another phone call from Keith 418. This time, we'll start discussing goals and what they do for the Thelemic organization. In between these segments, I'll continue to talk about the podcast and also a book that I just received and think is great. Lastly, I'll end the podcast with another song from Chakra. Now that the preliminaries are done, let's jump right back into the interview with Bishop T. Allen Greenfield.
To change the subject to some more kind of concrete things about the philosophy or religion of Thelema, since you've been involved with it for so long, I assume you've interacted with the Book of the Law, Liber of Veligis, during that time period?
I would say from the very earliest exposure to it, it's very hard. It's very hard to not have an initial relationship with that particular book, since it more or less is first on the priority list of just about everyone who writes on the subject, with the possible exception of Israel Regardie, who seems to have had a broader view of Aleister Crowley and what was or was not important about his life.
What is your perceptions or ideas about the Book of the Law?
Like all other holy books, and I'm not putting that in quotes, I would say all other books that people regard with reverence, I think it needs to be examined on its own merits and its own say-so in terms of how it affects the individual and how it applies to their life. If it serves a person well, that's good for them. If it doesn't, that's perhaps they should look elsewhere. At the same time, I don't hold anything above inquiry, deconstruction, evaluation, and just as there is what's called higher biblical criticism, I think there should be higher criticism of the Book of the Law, or for that matter, anything that is a purported holy book in terms of its origin, its meaning, its value to civilization, and its value to the individual.
What is your take on the reception story with Iwas and the 3 days in Cairo and so forth?
That it's metaphorical.
So you don't think it's a literal reception, that there's some praetor human entity dictating the Book of the Law to Crowley over 3 days?
I have no idea whatsoever, since there were only two human beings in the room, to the best of my knowledge, both of whom are dead, neither of whom I have the opportunity to interview. I've read extensively what Aleister Crowley has to say about that, but I've also read his earliest notes on the subject, and they were quite different from his later opinions. Which are more correct, I think, is probably more, at this point, a matter of belief and not something really that the historian can do more than note that his initial notations were somewhat less enthusiastic than his later opinions on the subject. I think that it is a work of considerable profundity, and it does speak to the times that we live in. One of my favorite notions is that it is a very short holy book, as holy books go. And we do live in the era of short attention span theater. That is just the nature of modern human beings. And if you compare it simply size-wise to, let's say, the Bible considered as a whole, or the Quran, or even any collection of the Buddhist sutras, you would find that that it's a quick read, and as someone pointed out, you can read it in a single sitting without any problem, and that's consistent with the times we live in. Then, of course, you have to evaluate the content, what it means in terms of your own being and your own feelings about it, and I've seen it be very inspirational to some people in the positive sense. I've seen it turn into fundamentalist fanaticism, just as every other holy book that has ever been generated, from the Book of Exodus to the Book of Mormon. And I find fanaticism and superstitious belief in anything to be abhorrent and contradictory to a progressive view of human development.
Is Liberal a holy book to you, or meaningful to you?
It depends on how you use the term. Is it sacrosanct to the point that it is above being questioned? See my previous comment on fundamentalism of any sort. I'm not a fundamentalist about anything. Is it important? Has it played an important role in my life? Does it continue to? Yes.
Okay. What are your opinions about Aleister Crowley and your take on Crowley's life or his position as the prophet of Thelema, his writings, his commentaries, and so forth?
He's unquestionably and by definition the prophet of Thelema. I mean, that's a given. Now, what that means in terms of world history, I think we're a little early in that history to really make a judgment of that. A fair comparison would be, where was Christianity at the year 100, which is what we are approximately, of the Common Era? It was still a little isolated sect, and quite debatable as to whether it would even continue or not. But unquestionably, the Crowley is the prophet of the Book of the Law and the prophet of the Aeon as he describes it. What that means in terms of world history, we'll just have to see.
There are a lot of people.
Crowley as a person, it depends on the subject. You would have to break it down. Crowley is poet, pretty good. Crowley is mountaineer, impulsive, but pretty good. Crowley as a writer of inspired works, excellent. Crowley as organizational leader, disaster. Crowley as a person to refer to on the personal relationships, disaster. Crowley as a person to refer to on matters of finance, disaster. So it's all in what you're talking about. I would not rate him as someone that I would like to have a beer with, but if he were lecturing in town, I'd certainly be sure to go see him.
Well, there's a lot of talk, even a whole conference last year on the 100-year anniversary of Thelema getting beyond Crowley. Do you think that's a valid idea, that Crowley can be separated from Thelema?
Well, separated, no. But will it outgrow him? He predicted that it would, or at least he hoped that it would. I would be loath to cite from memory where he says that, although I'm sure that he says that in the autobiography, or if you prefer, autohagiography, which I think is getting his sense of humor involved, but he said that he envied the magicians of the future having access to the techniques that he was only beginning to pioneer, because they would have the benefit of additional generations of trial and error. He was a scientific illuminist at the beginning of his career, prior to the Book of the Law, and at the end of his career, when he was an elderly, wheezing heroin addict in Brighton. That's a consistency in his life, and I don't think he ever envisioned himself as being the end of something. He kind of hoped he would be the beginning. So those who want to sort of rigidify and leave in time every word, gesture, and cigar that he smoked, I think are kind of missing the point of the man's entire career.
Well, how about the, we were speaking before about Liberal. Could somebody reject Liberal altogether and still remain a Thelemite or a scientific illuminist?
I think it's entirely possible that there are many people out there in the world who have, who live, I'm loath to use the term, a Thelemic life, who have never read the Book of the Law, never heard of it, and are not directly influenced by it. Either one believes that there is objectively a new eon, in which case one would expect it to affect everyone in one sense or another, or one makes the judgment that that is at best allegorical or metaphorical or however you want to term it. It doesn't seem to me that that reference to the book is the crucial element in being being true to oneself and understanding oneself so that one can be true to oneself is the issue. And obviously, by definition, many of those who Crowley himself characterized as Gnostic saints in Liber 15 had never read the Book of the Law, as it hadn't been written yet.
So,
but that doesn't mean that they were not transmitters of the light at the Gnosis.
Right.
And I think that would be equally true today. It's a handy tool to have, but one can do it without. And I probably, given a few minutes, could think of people that I would consider to be precisely in that category who are alive and walking the earth today. And in fact, again, if you subscribe to the notion of a new eon, then one would expect it to grow beyond any kind of small community of organized or unorganized people and become something that has an impact on the entire world. If, on the other hand, you consider it simply to be a cult favorite, as it were, then that's of no importance to you. But that, I think, impact on the world is, well, it's important to me and probably important to most thinking people.
So are you saying that somebody could be a practitioner of another religion and still be a Thelemite?
In as much as, well, first of all, one either is or is not attempting to know their will and to do their will. That is not something that became true because it is written in the Book of the Law. It's either true or not true. And my own always tentative but nevertheless firm opinion on that is that it is true. And it's true whether you've read the Book of the Law or not. If a person is doing it, they're doing it. And I would expect it to escape after X number of years from its initial impetus, any particular writing, and get out into a broader community. At least I would hope so. If it's something of value, I certainly hope that that is the case. It doesn't hurt. It may indeed enhance if one has read the Book of the Law, but not if one puts the universe in the box of saying it's the book, therefore we should behave such and such, as opposed to the book gives me the truth, and therefore I behave in such and such a manner. All holy books have rules. It seems to me that the rules set out in the Book of the Law are rather limited in scope. Do what thou wilt shall be the whole of the law.
Well, how does ceremonial magic then, if Crowley used ceremonial magic as the primary vehicle, that and yoga, to further his explorations of a Thelemic system and the Thelemic universe, whether it be scrying the Enochian universe and getting the vision and the voice, or the various other magical techniques and rituals that he did. How does ceremonial magic fit into this? And are you saying that ceremonial magic is, you know, just a means and not necessarily vital to Thelema, and that other means can be used and beyond ceremonial magic?
Absolutely. Ceremonial magic is a technique that involves a type of focus and a type of equilibrium to do it successfully, which can enhance one's knowledge of self and one's ability to manifest oneself in the universe. It's not the only means. Yoga, you mentioned, is another technique which certainly has a long history of success. And of course, there are people who use ceremonial magic for precisely the opposite purpose, as Crowley was the first to acknowledge. That is, people who use it to manipulate others, manipulate things into being that perhaps have the quality of enslaving rather than of liberating. It's a tool that can be used, and I have a taste for it myself, but I can see someone having zero interest in that subject who is, let us say, a painter, and whose technique is to manifest their will by being an excellent painter who never did a ceremonial magic in their life.
But can a painter, you know, exercising their will through those means, expect to get to the same kind of place that Crowley did? I mean, if we have Crowley as the comparison or the baseline, and he used various techniques of yoga and ceremonial magic, how can we discard those means and come up with the other means and claim to get to the same place, especially when there seems to be so few people actually attaining the level of adeptship that Crowley got?
Well, that's a very interesting point. First of all, one should always engage in critical analysis as to what level of adeptship any given human being has attained. That's a real difficult thing to assess from the outside. That is largely a matter of radical, direct, intuitive knowledge of the universe on the part of the individual. But aside from that, no, I think Crowley would be horrified at the notion that one should try to be him, to live
not
what
necessarily
would be
Alan, not necessarily be him, but use the same techniques and manners he used.
I don't know that he ever said that the same techniques were necessarily applicable. In fact, again, referring to those he considered the transmitters of the light of the Gnosis, which is not exhausted by the traditional list of Gnostic saints by any means, the kind of people that he held up to be good examples of the type of person that he thought were in touch with their own will and doing their own will in the world, I think that you would find people who were very, very different from him. In fact, his writings on the subject of genius should be referenced in that regard. He wasn't looking for cookie-cutter copies of himself, and that would include the particular techniques. What did he and Gauguin have in common? Crowley was an artist, but I would not call him an artist of the first rank. Gauguin, by general consensus, was, and that was his life. That doesn't mean that he was exposed to the specific techniques. Perhaps he and Crowley had absinthe in common, but that would be about it, you know. And I really don't think that that's necessary. It's not necessary to approach things in the same manner to achieve the same ends. Those ends can be used by people who are not suited to them, and it can actually have the reverse effect. It can cause them to become mechanistic and falling back on routine without ever examining their own will, let alone doing it.
So, okay, let's say then, you know, Thelema continues to evolve. Where do you see Thelema in the next 5, 10, 20, 50, or 100 years? Where do you see it going?
Interesting. I think that if it is, in fact, what it claims to be, it will have a higher impact on the world. For its higher impact on the world to take place, I would see a need for certain changes to take place within the Thelemic community, and particularly the organized Thelemic community, and those changes have yet to take place. They may be in some fatalistic sense inevitable if this is inevitably going to happen. On the other hand, it may be that people spontaneously come to the philosophy, whether they happen upon the Liberal or they happen upon ideas that would be coincident with it.
Now, you mentioned another organization. Did you have any organizations in particular in mind on guiding Thelema in the next 10, 20, 50 years?
I don't. I think really the organizational constructs that exist could be utilized for the purposes that I'm mentioning. But I don't think that there are existing organizations that I would refer people to as preferential. Others might come into existence. It may be inevitable that they do, but that isn't the case, nor do I see anything on the horizon that would that I would be inclined to recommend. There needs to be a fundamental reassessment of just what is done, and there needs to be a certain seriousness about what it is that is being done. What are the limitations of organized bodies of manifestation, and also on the other side of it, what can they do that they're not doing? There's a great deal, I think, and I've alluded to some of it here.
Now, so do you see Thelema or the new eon manifesting larger than any one person or group of people or country or continent? I mean, is it, in your opinion, like a phase the whole world is going through, and or some energies the universe is manifesting at this time, or I mean, what is your take on the new eon?
Well, there are no guarantees in history about anything, but I think that the tendency for people to learn about themselves and to manifest their themselves, capital S, in the world is a relatively new idea. By the way, this is going to terminate in 30 seconds. I hear from my announcer, so you may want to retool.
All right. Do you want to say anything about your book before we head out?
Just that the name of it is The Roots of Magic, 1700 to 2000, an anthology. And if you can't get it elsewhere, try barnesandnoble.com or amazon.com. They certainly have it.
Wonderful. Well, thank you very much for being on Thelema Coast to Coast. And I wish you success on your book. And I will talk to you later. Bye-bye.
Books. Every Thelemite loves books, or so it seems. I've often heard the joke that every Thelemite's library looks the same. In reality, I'm sure this is only half true. I can guarantee books like 777 and Magic will be present, but there are always other books that reflect the preferences of each particular Thelemite. One of the books that I'm pleased to see on the market is the Journal for the Academic Study of Magic. It's an annual journal published by Mandrake Press in the UK, and I just received the second issue. Some of the essays are interesting, like the metaphysical relationship between magic and miracles, or the human body and Southern Slavic folk sorceries. Others, less so. The thing I like most about the journal is that there are a few publications out there that examine esoteric metaphysics in an academic way. I'm thrilled to see this journal get to issue number 2 and be twice as large as issue number 1. There's not enough academic research being done about magic, Thelema, and other occult topics. I'd love to see other academic journals appearing, exploring the subjects like Thelema, Enochian and Goetic work, Hermetic Kabbalah, etc. But to do this, we need more people to take the subject serious. We need more people to do serious academic work, write about it, and we need the magical communities to support this kind of work. Aren't you sick of the continuous mountain of beginner's books? How many books do we need published to explain how to do the lesser banishing ritual of the pentagram? How many books do we need to explain the basics of Asana? Wouldn't you prefer more substantive books? The point is that the majority of the material published in the New Age or occult book section is crap, and the reason it is published is because people buy it. When academic or specialized books come out, they don't get purchased. Why? Once you have a few, you don't need more beginner's books. I encourage all the people listening to start challenging yourselves and start obtaining material that really expands your understanding of these esoteric systems. I've been doing so for quite a while, and I have really gained much from it. Also, when you see journals on non-standard subjects, buy them and read them. The scholarship in them is usually very impressive. I've been blown away by some of the essays. Please support these kind of publications. They make significant contributions to our communities and offer one way to greatly increase our own understanding. To see the webpage for the Journal for Academic Study of Magic, go to the Thelema Coast to Coast website. You'll find a link there. Now that I've gone on about this one book, let's see what's new and exciting from Magus Books.
Hail and welcome, folks, to the Magus Books Insider Book Report, brought to you by Joseph A. Amara of MagusBooks.com. Do what thou wilt shall be the whole of the law. For those of you unfamiliar with Magus Books, we are an online retailer that has been serving the magical community since 1992. We also have a brick-and-mortar shop in Minneapolis, Minnesota, but we do business all over the world. We are dedicated to supplying anyone on a spiritual quest with the information and materials they need upon their journey. Thelema Coast to Coast has asked us to give regular reports on new and interesting products that may be of interest to its listeners. Magus Books is constantly searching the planet for hard-to-find items that we then make available to you. Today I thought I'd give you just a few examples. One book that many of us are very excited about is Practical Angel Magic of Dr. John Dee's Enochian Tables by Stephen Skinner and David Rankine. This is a book that has been a very long time coming. Many of us started to hear about it in various email discussion groups as long as 2 years ago. Now that it is finally available, I can say that it does not disappoint. This book contains a complete transcription of the Tabulorum, Bonorum, Angelorum, Invocationes, which is a manuscript that has never been previously published. In the book, the authors tell the story of what happened to this most important manuscript of Dr. John Dee. It was the personal angelic invocations which he kept for himself in Latin. Apparently, it was developed by 17th century magicians into a full magical working system. The authors detail how only a small part of this material actually reached the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn in the 1880s. And how apparently even these fragments were suppressed by the chiefs of that order. There are many interesting tidbits in this work, including the role of Elias Ashmole, who is famous for being the first verifiable speculative Freemason, in the early development of this material in the 17th century. The book is a beautiful hardcover tome of 295 pages and is beautifully laid out in two-color red and black print. It is limited to 1,500 copies, and it is actually the first in a series of books that will be called The Sourceworks of Ceremonial Magic, Magus Books is the only retailer selling this book in North America at its cover price of $65. There are others out there selling it for more, so please be careful. Because of the splash that this book has created, there has been an increased interest in the other works by the same authors. One that I thought I'd point out to you is by David Rankine, and it's worth a good look. It's entitled Becoming Magic, New and Revised Magics for the New Aeon. The reason I bring this book up is that it is a great chance for American Thelemites to see into the world of English Thelema, which does have a slightly different flavor. It covers many magical techniques that have been around for a while, but it also does present a lot of new and interesting ideas that we do not see much coverage of in American literature. Ideas such as magical ingestion and working magic during illness, for example. If you're in the mood for something different and yet still within a Thelemic context, you might find that it's worthwhile to check this one out. Now, magicians do not live by books alone. And one of the most common questions I get from magicians is, where the heck do I find all that stuff in 777 when building my rituals? The answer I always give is the same, of course. Well, you find them at Magus Books. We have worked very hard to dig up some of the hard-to-find incenses and resins that are listed in 777. For example, we have just gotten hold of a new batch of liquid Starax. This stuff is very good, and it's the perfect thing for rites of Mercury. Magus sells it in easy-to-open and access wide-mouth 2-ounce jars for $19.95 apiece. Another incense that many people find difficult to find is red myrrh, which is also sometimes called Yemenese myrrh. Now, you can find myrrh all over the place, but Yemenese myrrh is a deep red color, and it burns much, much cleaner than ordinary myrrh. It is spendy at $13.95 an ounce, but if you keep in mind that you use much less of it than you would when using standard myrrh, you'll see that it doesn't end up being that bad. Give it a try and you'll see what I mean. Speaking of high-grade incenses, if you're in the market for some good frankincense, we have the spring batch of Hajari frankincense in. This is considered the top grade of frankincense available today, and it's not very easy to find. Magus sells it for $6.95 an ounce. If that's too spendy for you, keep in mind we do have several other grades of frankincense, starting at around $2.25 an ounce. All of these products, we'll have links to them on the Thelema Coast to Coast website. Or if you have any questions, feel free to drop me an email. You can email me personally at Joseph, J-O-S-E-P-H, at magusbooks.com. That's magusbooks.com. Or you can always give us a call at Magus, toll-free at 1-800-99-MAGUS. And, of course, you can always check out everything we offer at www.magusbooks.com. Love is the law, love and the will. For the Magus Books Insider Report in Thelema Coast to Coast, this has been Joseph A. Amara giving you the word on the new and latest stuff. May all of your interest, all of your evenings be interesting.
In the last podcast, when we spoke with Keith 418, he started talking about goals and how they can transcend individual differences in ideology. On this podcast discussion, Keith 418 and I further discuss goals and examine where goals lead to. Hello, Keith, this is John from Thelema Coast to Coast. Are you there?
I am. Go right ahead.
How are you doing this evening?
I'm doing fantastic.
Well, when we last spoke, we started talking about goals. And you were saying that goals allow us to get away from ideology. Can you expand on that?
Well, you know, I think that people need to look at goals as a way to come to accord on things and work together. And I mean, I think that in general, if we're both working on goals that we think are important, we can put aside a lot of our, you know, ideological battles or nitpicking difficulties about various kinds of texts, you know, what Freud used to call the narcissism of small differences, and work on the things that will benefit both of us. And I think this is really kind of where the OTO is falling down in a lot of ways, in that it sort of gets subsumed in these, you know, sort of picky confrontations over little tiny things and doesn't really have huge numbers of goals to unite everyone around. And what are the goals we need to be working on? And, yeah, I saw a lot of this when I worked in politics, and I wanted to say parenthetically that, you know, I noticed today in some of your writing, you talk a lot about your experiences at work, you know, in school, from people people you know. And I think it's important to do that. I think too few of our fellow members in the community really tie in their life experiences to their insights into magic and the way the community could function better. And I think this is unfortunate. But, you know, I always saw that you could unite a whole group of people if you all got together and worked on goals. And there were people that I used to do work with in the nonprofit community that I didn't really like that much, but that I have a profound sense of fraternity and brotherhood with, because we worked hard together on goals that were very difficult and very demanding. And throughout my life, I know I'm going to have a connection with these people that will be very profound, even though at times they drove me crazy and I disagreed with them about any number of issues. And I think this is sort of what the community is kind of lacking, in a sense, is that it doesn't have this goal-oriented focus, this direction towards how can we get everyone united and on the same page. And I think the leadership needs to look at this, because its magazines, its newsletters, its communication with its members really don't seem to me to be focused on how do we get everyone on the same page so we all know what the goals are and what we need to be working on. Instead, you know, it's these sort of vague homilies and, you know, kind of fatherly bits of advice that aren't very directed towards specific ends. And I think that's a problem.
Well, okay. A lot of people are saying that we have goals, that the order has the founding documents, 101, 194, and so forth, and that the goals are pretty explicit directly from Crowley.
Okay, well, I don't think that's a bad point to bring up. I mean, I think that his vision for the organization is, you know, fairly developed for what he was able to do. The question is, real goals are not vague ideas or even plans like that. They're things that are strategically planned, they're measurable, there's accountability involved, who is responsible for what, they're realistic, there's a timeline set. I mean, Crowley talks about any number of things. What's the timeline for them? Without real measurable issues, without things that have to be done by a certain time with specific people in charge, we don't really have goals. Those are like vague postulates unless they're tied into actual plans that actual people are accountable for in a real way. And somebody coming into the order could be told, oh, yeah, you know, these are our plans, these are our goals, but when? 100 years from now? 200 years from now? 20 years from now? 5 years from now? The leaders won't tell us. What do they expect in 5 years? What do they expect in 20? Those aren't goals. If we don't know when we're supposed to get to them, that's not a real goal.
So if they're not real goals, are they even plans, or are they just more of an outline of ideas?
Well, I think they could be seen as plans. They could be seen as visions. You could characterize them any number of ways. I personally would like to see everything Crowley describes in those to the fullest extent that we can envision them and make them possible in real life, to the fullest extent we can materialize them. But that's not going to happen unless there's a way to get there that's very concrete, that is clear, and that everybody understands. And if it involves raising funds, then raise the money. If it involves, you know, hiring people to come up with, you know, definite building structures, architectural plans, then hire them. To me, everything seems kind of vague. It seems sort of like, well, when the members decide that's what they want, then I guess we'll have it sometime in the future, and there's never any real impetus to achieve those things in the immediate sense. At least I don't feel that impetus saying, hey, Keith, this is what we want in 5 years, and this is what we want you to do to contribute towards it.
What do you think is stopping them from creating concrete goals?
Well, I don't think they're used to thinking about the OTO or the FLEMA community in concrete terms. I mean, I think one of the saddest things about this is that most of the members and a lot of the leaders tend to look at the community as some sort of refuge from reality. It's where they go, where they don't get judged, where they can do, you know, pretty much anything they want and get a free pass, where, you know, no one is holding them accountable, where, you know, their freedom in an unconditioned kind of way is endorsed. And if you are looking for that kind of environment, having the sort of strategic goals that you and I want to see isn't going to make you very happy. If you want to make it be anything you want it to be and don't want anyone telling you what to do, then having somebody set goals and try to hold you accountable isn't going to be what you want. So there's a lot of resistance coming from, you know, some of the members and some of the leaders to that kind of environment. The leaders want to be leaders, but they don't really want to tell anyone what to do. And the followers will accept the leaders as long as no one tells them what to do.
What I find curious about this is, that attitude is almost the antithesis of Thelema.
Of course it is. That's why having the problems that we're having, because no one is really confronting that problem. That's the crisis, and in a large part, that's the crisis that the community faces.
It makes me wonder how familiar the community is with the material, and if they have read it, how well they understand it.
Well, who is challenging them to look at it? I mean, are our leaders telling them, hey, look, you know, you really have to read this material because we're going to put it into effect, because if you don't read it, you're going to fall behind. Is that their attitude, or is it, hey, you know, if you like it, that's great. If you don't, hey, that's great too. I mean, one of the things a friend of mine mentioned to me a long time ago was that certain people had a conflict with Timothy Leary back in the 60s because Leary basically believed that you could achieve enlightenment without conflict. Goal setting of the kind that I'm talking about, and any meaningful goal setting, involves a level of confrontation. You have to say, what we have now is not perfect, we need to change it. This threatens people. They don't want to have that confrontation. The leaders don't want to provoke that confrontation, they don't want to initiate it, and the members don't want to have anyone initiating it on them. So if we've all agreed not to have that confrontation, then how can we have any goals? This is the kind of problem I see the leadership facing. It knows it needs to have goals. It knows it needs to change things. These people aren't stupid. But at the same time, it wants to convince itself it can make those changes and institute those goals without a confrontation of some kind. That's just flat out impossible. Well, there has to be a confrontation.
A good example of this is their mission statement that they came out with about 6 months ago after much prodding from other people, including yourself and myself. What I find interesting is that they had their rollout of the mission statement, made a big deal, had all this fanfare, put it in Agape, put it on the website, and we've heard nothing of it since. To me, from my understanding of what an organizational mission statement is, that's something that you bounce everything off. You compare everything that you do to it and see if it falls within the mission statement. I don't see them doing that at all. So I wonder, how meaningful is that mission statement? Is it really just something to placate people, or is it something meaningful to the organization?
Well, let's look at what the leaders face. On the one hand, they face a significant number of dedicated, concerned, active members who really don't like Crowley and are really kind of hostile to the aristocratic values within the Thelemic structure. You know, they don't like the fact that the OTO has a hierarchy. They don't like the authoritarian aspect of it. They don't like the fact that it's not a democracy. We hear these complaints all the time. People are very critical of Crowley and his positions when it comes to any conflict with secular humanism. And on the other hand, you have very dedicated, very hardworking, very intelligent people who feel very strongly that Crowley is right, that the status quo contemporary Western civilization is wrong, and that Thelema is really about these different values, these different perspectives, and who really want to see the Crowley ideas brought into being. Well, how do you placate both of those parties? How do you make both sides happy? If you move towards a position that's critical of Crowley, you alienate the people who like him. If you move towards a position that's supportive of actually creating the structures Crowley talked about, you're going to alienate all the people who are threatened by that. So the leaders are sort of caught between a rock and a hard place. They have to placate both parties. That's not going to be easy to do.
Why don't they just make a decision, say that's the way we're going, and let the chips fall? I mean, isn't that what a leader does?
You'd think so, but maybe they've been doing this for so long, or maybe they've come up with some kind of rationalization that makes them think that they can, you know, make their changes without anyone really having that moment of confrontation, or, you know, the come to Jesus meeting, if you'll pardon the expression. I don't know. I see it as being an inevitability. And I see delaying that confrontation over what they really want to do to be, you know, just drawing the agony out.
Well, the other thing is, if they're afraid of losing people from going one side or the other, their inaction also causes them to lose people. And probably the more meaningful people are the ones who can help the organization the most, because those are the ones who get fed up with the inactivity, low standards, and stagnation of the order.
Oh, I totally agree with you. I think that's a problem. So now I think the mission statement and, you know, the goals that we're hearing about and the committees and so forth are really an attempt to kind of placate those people and say, hey, look, you know, we hear you and we're trying to do this. So what's going to come of that? I don't really know. I mean, I still see a problem in that, You know, on the one hand, they say they want goals, but on the other hand, they seem very unwilling to confront or to hold people accountable. And this goes back a long ways. This isn't anything new for the organization. Go and look at the Claudia Kowalczyk study again. You know, she talks about people making mistakes, making errors, not doing what they were supposed to be doing, and never getting called on it.
Well, the the lack of accountability in the order and the inconsistent nature in which policies are implemented also have a serious negative effect on the order.
Well, how can you have serious goals if you're not going to hold people accountable? I mean, that just doesn't work. How are you going to have serious goals if you're not going to implement the policy you already have? I mean, one of the things that I find interesting, and I don't know if we've talked about this before, but you can look at certain parallels between what goes on in the United States government and what goes on in the Thelema community. You know, on the one hand, we have a government that doesn't want to enforce the laws it already has, but instead make new laws to deal with the problems, you know, continually thinking that somehow creating a new law is going to solve the problem. Well, the OTO makes new policy rather than enforcing the policy that it already has. You know, these endless policy changes, these endless policy issues, I think this is really an indication of the organization's directionlessness and its struggle to actually find some sort of meaning. I don't think it's an indication of any real leadership.
Well, I think policy creating is you know, a lack of leadership. I mean, policy is part of the process, but it's no substitute for leadership.
Right, but again, I mean, I think that a lot of times people feel that leading by policy enables them to avoid confrontation. They don't have to tell a single individual, like, you screwed up, this was the problem. They can just make a policy and hope that people read it and that they'll stop doing whatever it is they don't want them to do.
Well, that's very common in corporate America, and we all know that it's completely ineffective. If you don't confront the offenders of the policies, then they will continue doing it because they know that the management or the leadership is afraid to confront them about it. And so they end up pushing things to such a limit that they either get fired or something drastic has to happen.
Right, like a lawsuit. And one of the things that I think is unfortunate is the way that, you know, it seems that, you know, a proactive position saying this policy is here because this is what we want to do in this period of time, that makes sense. But not having any goals and having a policy is sort of like not telling children what to do, only telling them what not to do. I mean, if you have toddlers around the house or little kids and you don't give them projects and things to do, they get into trouble. And this is, you know, without infantilizing the community any more than it already is, which would be difficult to do in certain circumstances, I think this is the problem the OTO leaders have. They don't want to tell people what to do, but they can only tell them what not to do. So how do people know, even when they're doing well, how do they know what they're supposed to be doing? You know, it's very interesting. I mean, I see, you know, a lot of times people are saying, well, we want the bodies to have separate facilities. This is a big issue. But where's the situation set up where people can buy? I mean, right now what they're saying is we want all of your members to make a landlord rich and rent. But that's not going to be a long-lasting solution. That's a part-time solution. Where's the mandatory dues? Where are the bank accounts? Where are the efforts to really create lasting structures? They're just not there. Now, on the one hand, the members say, oh, the members aren't ready for this. But they're not ready for it because they've never been given any goals or been ever been held accountable. This is a self-fulfilling prophecy.
We're out of time. But I think this is a good stopping point, and on the next podcast, perhaps we'll start talking about property and the requirements to gain property, and the requirements to hold on to property, and the things that it requires the organization to do, the seriousness involved, and the commitment involved.
Great.
So I really appreciate you coming on this podcast, and I will talk to you soon.
No problem. Take care, John.
93.
For those of you who don't know, there's a film being made about Aleister Crowley called Perodabo, The Life and Times of Aleister Crowley. This is being done by New Eon Films. They also have a few other projects, including a documentary about the Gnostic Mass called Behind the Veil, The Gnostic Mass Revealed. There is a sample of the Gnostic Mass movie on their website, www.neweonfilms.com. Also on the website is an interview with well-known occult author Lon Milo Duquette. The interview is very informative. I highly recommend it. I'll put all the links to these movies on the Thelema Coast to Coast website. We're coming to the end of another podcast. As I mentioned in the previous podcast, I'm open to any Thelemic PodSafe music. That is, any music that I can be given rights to play. If you have Thelemic music, let me know. I'd love to hear it. Also, I'm interested in having some kind of show introduction, but lack the equipment to create it. If anyone hearing this program wants to create one, I'd be most appreciative, and definitely give credit. Regardless if you have music or not, please email me comments and suggestions about the show at podcast@thelemacoasttocoast.com or visit the Thelema Coast to Coast website, www.thelemacoasttocoast.com, and leave a message in the blog. This closing song is called Thelema and is by the group Chakra. As I said before, I don't know much about this group. These songs were on a tape sent to me in the mid-90s. If you know anything about the group, please email me. Thanks again for listening to this podcast, and I hope you will stick around for the next. Love is the law, love under will.
Thelema is the will, the prophet falls, can and will. The beast has arisen, the Antichrist has come. Thelema's for everyone. Thelema is the will, the mighty can and will. Devour us all if you don't want to die. Thelema must be the Lord. Christianity, the universal Lord.